From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, Congressman Stephen Lynch on the GOP health plan and the fact that he's got a Democratic primary challenger, plus a conversation with Sarah Weddington. 45 years ago, she argued before the Supreme Court in Roe v. Wade and won.
Do I get from this, then, that your case depends primarily on the proposition that the fetus has no constitutional rights?
It depends on saying that the woman has a fundamental constitutional right and that the state has not proved any compelling interest for regulation in the area.
Were you nervous?
Yes. And part of it was because the outcome of that case was so important. It was going to affect the lives of countless women across this country for years. And the only thing is, if you had said to me that day, you're still going to be talking about this in 44 plus years, I wouldn't have believed that.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the wee hours this morning, the Republican health reform plan cleared its first hurdle, the House Ways and Means Committee. This afternoon, it cleared hurdle number two, the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Both were party line votes. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he now wants to push the bill through the full House in just a couple of weeks, which means that fairly soon, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch will get to cast his vote. And he joins us now. Congressman Stephen Lynch, welcome back to the show.
Good to join you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. So when the GOP health plan does land in the House, how are you going to vote?
Oh, I'll oppose it. This has been sort of a fire drill process here. There have been more, I think, tax cuts for select industries than there have been really debates about the quality of health care in the bill. And what might happen to Medicare and Medicaid. And so it looks as though it would damage both of those programs. And so, you know, clearly it's not going in the direction that we had hoped, where, you know, there might be some improvements. This is really a slash and burn attempt. As you mentioned at the outset, they did this in a 27-hour session without hearings, markup. So I've never seen anything operated like this. This has really been, like I say, sort of a fire drill. There's been no open debate. There's been no serious consideration of amendments. And
Democrats said they were going to try and offer some 100 amendments, but apparently, you know, that none of those made it their way into the bill, which is going to go before the full House eventually. Congressman Lynch, let me just step back here for a second, because as some folks might remember, you actually voted against the Affordable Care Act.
I did.
Now known as Obamacare, back in 2010, because you had certain concerns about it, that there was no public option, and that there was that so-called Cadillac tax on expensive or high cost plans, amongst other reasons. Is there nothing in the new GOP reform plan, nothing at all that you see moves that could potentially move healthcare forward? Is it a complete no for you?
Well, they do maintain the requirement that insurance companies can't deny you coverage for pre-existing conditions. They've kept that aspect of it, and also I believe dependent children can still stay on a parent's plan until age 26.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two good things, but there's still, you know, this is the extreme in the other direction, where there's no support for you know, people who are, I would say, the middle-income group that is, remember, the stress is being caused because of rising prices.
Right.
Rising costs, and that doesn't seem to be alleviated at all here.
Yeah. So let me ask you, there's this notion, we're seeing reports that, for example, that President Trump has said that, say, this new GOP plan doesn't clear the House or doesn't clear the Senate, that he's considering letting so-called Obamacare, in his words, quote unquote, fail so that the Democrats ultimately take the blame for no long-term change or long-term improvement in the American health insurance system. I mean, is that a concern for you?
I don't think that will sell. We've been prevented from, I think that President Obama and other Democrats realized that there were a lot of fixes necessary for the Affordable Care Act to succeed and to become sustainable. However, none of those efforts were undertaken by the Republican Congress, and so that effort never came around.
Mm-hmm.
In the first version of the Affordable Care Act, we did not have a tax on health care benefits. We did have the state option for a public option, a state-by-state opportunity for public options. That was taken out. We also prevented monopoly and cartels being created by enforcing the antitrust laws against insurance companies.
Right.
That was taken out. So none of those things has been changed in a favorable way in this new iteration of the repeal and replace bill.
Well, so that makes me wonder, Congressman. Now that there's this renewed legislative focus on some kind of health reform. This time it's coming from the GOP. I mean, we obviously don't know what's going to happen yet when it goes to a House vote and then maybe on to the Senate. But in the possibility that the GOP plan doesn't make it to President Trump's desk, is this a time for maybe for Democrats to push for or put forth a bill that that calls for all those things that you just mentioned that weren't in the Affordable Care Act back in in the mid 2000s?
I suppose,
2000s.
Yeah, theoretically you could.
Would you be interested in doing that?
Of course, but I don't think we would get the votes. But we could certainly offer that. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that version of the Affordable Care Act had over 300 members vote for it in the House. And then, of course, Scott Brown got elected. They couldn't get it through the Senate, and so we had to settle with this other version that was far less favorable and really not coherent. That's the deal we have now.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to proffer that bill and support it, but I'm not sure I could actually tell people that it have a realistic chance of passing.
Right. Well, let's move on and talk about a couple other issues that have to do with the U.S. military. Because as folks might recall, one of the first executive actions that President Trump took when he took office was issuing a memorandum that was calling for a hiring freeze on the entire federal government. But his chief of staff at the time repeated that the memorandum underscored that the memorandum did not apply to the U.S. military. Now, you and 23 House colleagues just signed a letter yesterday reminding the president of his promise to deliver for veterans in the same way that they say they're delivering for the nation. So what is your letter asking the president to do specifically?
Well, actually, I have a bill. It's H.R. 1001. I have over 120 co-sponsors. So the president put in a hiring freeze across the federal government, but I don't think he realized, or maybe he did, that we have 632,000 veterans who work for the federal government. It's 30% of our workforce in the federal government. So by putting this freeze in place, he denies all of those veterans who would normally be hired across our agencies at the VA, State Department, Defense Department, National Park Service, TSA. We hire a lot of veterans. It prevents them from going to work. So over the past, I would say, month, I've had numerous veterans looking for jobs in the federal government. I've sat down with a few of them, and I've had to explain to them that the positions that they're applying for is subject to the freeze, and then they can't go to work. So while we have these young men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in the military service, and we have elevated instances of suicide, we have elevated rates of homelessness and drug abuse, we're now putting up another barrier to their transition back to civilian life by saying, no, you can't go to work for the single largest employer of veterans in this country. and that's problematic. So my bill, H.R. 1001, would simply exempt veterans from the hiring freeze. So, for instance, I have 9,000 open requisitions over at the VA.
Yeah.
And if a veteran applied for that and was qualified, and I've had radiologists come into my office who, you know, obviously got their skills and training through the military, looking for jobs that they are eminently qualified for. So if my bill passed, they would be able to go to work. The bill would still apply, the freeze would still apply to the 70% of non-veterans that typically fill those positions.
Right, so it would just focus on not having the freeze for military veterans. Point
right.
taken. So let me just switch to another story here that has connections to the military. You know where I'm going with this. This is the annual St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston. For the past couple of years, an LGBTQ veterans group, OutVets, has been allowed to march in the parade. But of course, in years past, they weren't. This year, the group that organizes the parade is once again telling OutVets that they're not welcome and they're not going to be allowed to march. Congressman, this is your district. Is there anything you feel like you can do about this?
Well, sure. And actually, I'm in Washington right now, but it's my intention to resolve this in a way that allows OutVets to march once again. As you mentioned, they've marched for the last couple of years. And one of the years, I think it was 2 years ago, they marched right behind me, and they received a very warm and respectful welcome from the community. There were no problems. I talked to all of the marchers at the end of the parade where we sort of began to disperse. They were beaming with they were very, very happy with the response they got from the community, and as a result, they came back the next year.
Hmm.
So I just, so this is very surprising as well as troubling. We thought we had this resolved, and there's been no adverse consequences to any of this in the last couple of years. It's sort of, it hasn't been an issue.
Yeah.
But apparently this small group of individuals have influenced the Allied War Veterans Council to vote no, at least initially. I understand they've called for an emergency meeting. Myself, Mayor Walsh, Governor Baker, all the city councilors from the district, at large and district, as well as the state representative, Nick Collins, and Senator Linda DeSinafori, have all said either this changes or we will not march.
And yeah, but on the other hand, Congressman, if I can ask, I mean, as you well know, this issue went to the United States Supreme Court, and the court actually ruled that the Allied Council actually has a right to exclude participants based on their right to free speech. I mean, so they're not in violation of any laws by making this decision.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. That was a case where, these are gay veterans, so you're letting all these other veterans march, and you're excluding this other group. So I don't know if there's a legal distinction there but there's certainly a societal one.
Right.
I think that the overwhelming 99.9999% of the people there are saying, this is part of our parade. It's not a problem. These veterans have served the country. They deserve the right to march. We welcome them. And I just had John Afuso here from HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. He's one of the marchers from previous years, and we're trying to work with the Allied War Veterans to make sure that he and the OutVets group has an opportunity
right.
to march.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that that comes to a mutually agreeable conclusion. I've just got a minute left with you, Congressman, and I really, really want to ask you one last thing, because, as you know, you're facing a challenger in the Democratic primary in your district, and that challenge is coming from businesswoman and game developer Brianna Wu. We actually talked with her on the show a couple of weeks ago, and here's what she said about why she's running against you as a Democrat.
I personally don't consider him a Democrat. I look at his background on voting for reproductive health care. I look at some of the bills he tried to pass about LGBT rights. And, I personally think Massachusetts can do so much better.
Congressman, do you think that you have that you have sort of weakness on your left flank here, that there's room for a progressive challenger or someone who calls herself a progressive challenger like Breonna Wu to you?
I mean, really, I got sworn in 4 weeks ago. I got sworn in last month. I'm not going to start campaigning now.
The terms are only two years long. But Congressman, the terms are 2 years long in this day and age. I can't help it if the election season is never ending.
It does end for me. It'll start. So we have a process in Massachusetts where you get the signatures and you become a candidate. And look, I'm sure I'll have many candidates that'll be running against me, probably four or five. I had a couple last 2 years ago, and that happens. But in between elections, I have to do some work. And so I think it's a bit much, 5 weeks after I get sworn in on a two-year term, that I have to begin campaigning again, and we're going to start doing shows about, people who are running or not running. I really have to do my job. I took an oath. I owe this to the people that I represent. There is a cycle here. It's a two-year cycle. It's very, very brief.
Yeah.
Very brief. So the opportunity you have to just focus on your job is very limited.
Congressman,
and there'll be plenty of time to do a campaign and debates and all that stuff. But it's just not now.
Congressman,
and everybody has the right to run. Everybody has the right to run. God bless them.
I just want to jump in here and say that I take your point. And again, personally, as a citizen, do I love that the campaign seem never ending? No. But speaking of doing our jobs, I'm just doing my job, my due diligence here, because we had to ask you about that.
I know that.
Spent 20 minutes talking about other policies.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I look forward to having you back. Congressman Stephen Lynchy represents Massachusetts 8th. Thanks as always.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. WBUR has launched a new reporting project. It's called Bostonomics, and it's dedicated to covering the region's booming innovation economy. The Bostonomics team has a new editor and lead reporter, Asma Khalid. She might be a familiar name to you because Asma was a political reporter here at WBUR, but for the last year and a half, she crisscrossed the country for NPR covering the presidential election, and we're just so glad to have you back in Boston, Asma. Hello.
I am glad to be here, too. Though when I see the forecast and I see the snow, and I'm like, I really decided to come back at this moment.
You could be back in Florida at the moment. All right. Well, so let me just ask you, though. I mean, you did spend 18 months or so covering presidential politics nationally for NPR. Weather aside, why did you want to come back to Boston and cover tech and innovation?
So, Meghna, my beat during the election was demographics. You probably know this. I know we talked about some stories during the course of the campaign. And so I really was responsible for going to kind of key counties and key states all around the country, talking to voters. And I wanted to hear from voters, what they were excited about, as well as what they were scared about. And one of the things I realized that some people are very, very terrified of is losing their jobs. A very rightful concern. And we heard during the course of the campaign, some people were blaming immigrants for taking their jobs. But there were also other people I talked to who realized that the fact that, they don't have workers in the steel mills anymore is not because of, say, Mexicans. It was because of automation. And they were worried about what these changes in technology would mean for their future.
And so how specific were they in terms of what was making them so concerned?
So, Meghna, I have this very distinct memory of a gentleman I met in Youngstown. It's this working class region of Northeast Ohio. It was actually the last big reporting trip I took. It was right after the election. And I met this guy. His name is Leo Jennings III. He's a Democrat, a former union organizer. He had grown up in the shadow of the steel mills in Ohio. And he told me that that he had seen people, you know, sort of just in front of him lose their jobs. He said he was terrified of something that totally surprised me when he said this. He said driverless trucks. It just sort of came up, you know, in the midst of our conversation. I was like, well, what's, you know, what is there to be so concerned about yeah. around this realm? And he said that for his state, for Ohio, as in many of the sort of Midwestern states, it's a very common job. And so Leo told me that he actually hopes lawmakers just put the brakes on innovation, that around this autonomous vehicle, you know, world that we hear, we see a lot of it around Cambridge, that there's, he just thinks that lawmakers should say no, that there is some technology that we just should not invest in because of the threat that it has for people's jobs. And he said thousands of people are going to be without a job if, say, driverless trucks are our future.
Okay. So, I mean, so putting the brakes on technological innovation, of course, is anathema to so many people around here
true.
In the greater Boston area. I mean, so, but now you're covering that.
It is. And Meghna, that is, I would say, kind of precisely what drew me back to this area. I mean, it's sort of the flip side of this equation, right? I mean, I think that we are sort of in the midst of this technology revolution, you know, you could say that we're all living in. And so during the campaign, I met with a lot of people whose lives were affected by technology. And now it's the opportunity to sort of hear from the folks creating it or the folks even thinking about it, right, in sort of academic circles, economists, about what it all means. You know, I've met with a lot of folks already. I've just sort of started on the job. And I think within the Massachusetts economy, it's kind of hard to fathom what the effects are, right? Our unemployment rate is around 3%.
Very low, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so let me talk to you about this a little bit more because you'd mentioned driverless trucks. I read an article a long time ago about how, you know, around the entire trucking routes all across the United States, there's basically an economic ecosystem there as well, restaurants and all the businesses that are along the highways that are supported by the drivers who in these trucks. So it's not just the drivers themselves
no,
that could be affected by this technology.
That's so true, Meghna. And I mean, I don't. No, I mean, you sort of get a cross-section when you talk to people about how much I think they're thinking about this. One of the first weeks I was back, I went to an opening for Mass Robotics. It's a sort of shared workspace that they were opening up in the seaport. And I heard from a CEO of a robotics company who made a reference to a project that they were working on in reference to helping sort of laborers, so essentially automation that would help people pick strawberries. And he said essentially that people don't want to do these jobs. These are backbreaking, laborious jobs. And I sort of thought, like, is that true? I don't know, but this sort of conversation feels very divided.
Uh-huh. So tell me briefly if the folks that you've already talked to, getting Bostonomics fully up and running, if they are thinking more broadly about the impact their technology could have on the labor market.
I think a good number of people are, you know, even if they don't always have a solution. And Meghna, because of the story of this driverless trucks, Leo Jennings, who stuck with me, I often just ask people this question at sort of the end of interviews as we're talking. Yesterday, I met with Gil Pratt. He's the CEO of Toyota's Research Institute. It's the R&D division of Toyota. They're working on driverless cars, both here in Cambridge as well as Palo Alto. And you know, as I wrapped up the interview, I mentioned Leo's story to him, and he was sort of interested in chiming in on this. He told me that the goal of what Toyota is doing is not job replacement, and broadly, when it comes to driverless trucks, he's like, nobody's going to try to essentially replace drivers altogether. That's not, as he understands it, the goal. The goal is to make life easier and safer for drivers.
The truck driver would still be necessary, and of course, when the truck has to start and stop, move into the city at the beginning of the trip or at the end of the trip, then the human being could take over and then run those hard parts of the trip for it. So we don't see it as a black or white type of thing, and we actually think a lot of the potential benefit that we can have in the technology will not have a negative impact on jobs at all.
I imagine there's some people who say there's room for debate on that. But Asma, this is such an interesting conversation, and I look forward to seeing how you and the Bostonomics team are going to explore this in the coming weeks, months, years. So tell me, I mean, people probably have heard the Bostonomics moniker around WBUR. Just briefly, what is the team trying to accomplish?
So, Meghna, we're not sort of a traditional business section, I would say, of a newspaper. Our mission is to look at the people, startups, and companies driving the innovation economy that a lot of us are feeling and say, benefiting from sometimes not everyone is benefiting from around Boston. Just quickly, there are four of us. We each have a subbeat. I'll be looking at issues around the intersection of tech and policy, some stuff around robotics and AI. Then there's Bruce Gellerman, as I'm sure you all know. He focuses on energy. Zeninjor and Wameka, who's going to be focused on the nexus between culture and business. And lastly, Rachel Zimmerman, who's going to be covering health. You know, she's been a part of the Common Health team, but she's transitioning over to us. You know, we're getting underway, and I want to say that we welcome stray ideas and pitches and conversations. So if I could just make a really quick shameless plug.
Always.
We want folks to follow us on Twitter. So on Twitter, we are Bostonomics. That's spelled Boston, O-M-I-X. It's the place that we're updating most frequently. But, you know, if you don't really want to go on Twitter and whatnot, you can, of course, follow us on the old school radio as well.
On the old school radio. I'm still partial to the old school radio. Asma Khalid, Bostonomics reporter and editor, joining us today. Thank you, Asma, for stopping by, and look forward to hearing from you more.
You're welcome.
All right, well, let's move over to another tech story. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is saying that he's going to work directly with technology companies to help defend them against the CIA's hacking tools.
We have decided to work with them, give them some exclusive access to the additional technical details we have so that fixes can be developed and pushed out so people can be secured.
Now, this, of course, follows the fact that earlier this week, WikiLeaks published thousands of purported secret CIA files detailing the tools the agency uses to hack into computers, mobile phones, and other internet-connected devices. So joining us now with more on this is Hiawatha Bray, tech columnist for the business section of the Boston Globe. Hello, Hiawatha.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Constantly uncertain about cybersecurity, to be perfectly honest.
Well, people are listening to you anyway, so there's no point you're worrying.
So tell us more about what exactly the purported CIA capabilities here are that WikiLeaks did their big dump on.
Well, yeah. Well, basically what WikiLeaks did is to somehow get their hands on thousands of documents, many of which, according to WikiLeaks themselves, were for some bizarre reason not even classified, but were supposed to be locked in the bowels of the CIA, which describe a host of exploits, as they are sometimes called in the security world, weaknesses in a variety of commonplace operating systems that people use every day, including the operating systems of our iPhones, our Android devices, our Windows computers, Mac computers, Linux computers, and even some consumer devices, including Samsung television sets. There are people who do nothing at the CIA but try to find ways of tiptoeing around various security features on these devices, allowing them to basically tap into them without the user's knowledge. One of the things I want to say early up front, though it might be controversial in some circles, is I don't have a problem with this. This is what the CIA is supposed to do. If anything, what shocks me is the fact that their security is so lousy that it ends up getting out all over the world.
WikiLeaks, yeah.
Exactly. It is terrible security. But the CIA is actually doing its job. In fact, that's one of the weirdest things about all this. This is a good thing for them to be doing. But the question then arises, when they find these bugs, what should they be doing with them?
Well, so let me ask.
That's one of the key problems.
Exactly. So let me ask you about this, because it was, I don't know, back in 2010-ish, I believe, that President Obama actually said or promised that if the government gained knowledge of security flaws with technologies, that it would actually share that with the firm so that they could be fixed. But it doesn't
seem,
if we're to believe WikiLeaks, it doesn't seem as if the CIA has been doing this. Isn't that a problem?
That's really a very touchy problem. Now, that doesn't mean they have never done it. I'm sure, I hope anyway, that if something really terrible, like a couple of years ago, there was that thing called Heartbleed, which was found on millions of servers throughout the world and could have been used to steal practically everything. And I would hope that if they found something like that, they would recognize it's too dangerous. We've got to make sure the world knows about it. But they're probably thinking to themselves, this one isn't so bad, but we could use it to break into some terrorist smartphone. So let's put it on file somewhere. But that does seem to be in violation of an undertaking that the government has made that they won't do this. And it's a real moral conundrum, because on the one hand, they're saying we could make keep the country safer if we're able to spy on people. But on the other hand, if we don't tell people about these security flaws, criminals and terrorists and other agents could get in, and that makes the country less safe.
Right.
Where do you draw the line?
So we've just got under a minute to go here, Hiawatha. Yeah. But now we have Julian Assange saying he's going to do exactly that. He's going to share this with the tech companies and help them build tools against the CIA.
Right. Whatever you think about Julian Assange, this is exactly the right thing to do, because he should not release that information to the world until the companies that make this stuff have had a chance to fix the flaws. Apple says they already have run across some of these on their own and fixed them. we need to get all of these out as quickly as possible and get them fixed. But do I personally believe that there is something monstrous about the CIA doing this? I got to admit I don't. I'm just worried about where they draw the line, about how far they go, and how much they share to the rest of the world so that we can get our devices fixed so that the rest of the world isn't spying on us.
Hiawatha Bray, tech columnist for the business section of the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Hiawatha.
Thanks a lot.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On October 11th, 1972, U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Warren Burger introduced oral argument in one of the most consequential and controversial cases in American history.
First, in number 70, 18, Roe against Wade.
Arguing for legalization of abortion rights and on behalf of Jane Roe was Texas attorney Sarah Weddington.
Mrs. Weddington, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
She was 26 years old.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, we are once again before this court to ask relief against the continued enforcement of the Texas abortion statute.
That Texas statute at the time held that all abortions were illegal except those performed to save the life of the woman. Weddington argued that was unconstitutional.
We do not ask this court to rule that abortion is good or desirable in any particular situation. We are here to advocate that the decision as to whether or not a particular woman will continue to carry or will terminate a pregnancy is a decision that should be made by that individual, that in fact she has a constitutional right to make that decision for herself.
On January 22, 1973, the court issued its opinion. Seven of the justices agreed with Weddington, a decision that legalized abortion across the country. The fight over abortion never ended, of course. 44 years later, Roe v. Wade is one of the most simultaneously celebrated and reviled cases in U.S. history. It also defined Sarah Weddington's life and career. Weddington was honored by Harvard Law School this week in conjunction with International Women's Day. She joins us in the studio to talk about her life and about the continued debate over abortion rights today. Sarah Weddington, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Journalists have described you as maybe an unlikely person to get, at that time, to get fully involved in the manner that you did. Here's what one newspaper described you as, that you were hardly countercultural, middle class and married, the daughter of a Methodist minister, a person who headed her high school chapter of the Future Homemakers of America.
Now, I was also the drum major for the Canyon Junior High Band, and then I was the secretary of the freshman class at law school. You know, there were so few women then. When I was at Harvard Law School yesterday with some of their particularly women students and the dean, of course, who's a female, we were talking about the fact that at that point there were five women in my law school class out of about 250, you know, it was, we were such a small group.
This was in the 1960s, mid-1960s?
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
There was a lot of change and a lot of thinking about challenging laws restricting reproductive rights in Texas.
Yeah.
So tell us the story then of how you eventually met up with Linda Coffey, who was your co-counsel.
She was another woman out of the five who was in my class in law school.
Yeah.
And so this group of mostly women, two men, we were talking in the law school lounge one day, and they said, you know, we're really worried we're going to get prosecuted as accomplices to the crime of abortion for sending people to various places. We really think we need to file a lawsuit. And so I said I'd research it, and I did, and I came back, and we met again. And they said to me, Sarah, what would you charge us to bring a case against this law? And I said, oh, I'd do it for free. And they said, you are our lawyer.
Now, in those early days, before the case began making its way through the court system, I mean, what was your initial thought about the legal basis on which to challenge abortion restrictions?
There had been one prior case that was Griswold versus Connecticut. It was a case really about contraception, where contraception was illegal. And a woman named Estelle Griswold, who was the director of the New Haven Planned Parenthood, and her doctor, a man named Lee Buxton, had given a contraceptive device, as it's described in the case, to a married couple. They were arrested, prosecuted, and convicted of being, giving contraception, which was illegal. So they filed suit against that, and they won their case based on the 14th Amendment, which was privacy, that a woman has a right of privacy to decide for herself whether to continue or terminate a pregnancy. And so that was the basic thing we argued. But to tell you the truth, we also argued the 1st, the 4th, the 5th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 14th Amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Supreme Court hearing, that one of the judges said, in other words, Miss Weddington, anywhere we'll find it is okay with you. And I said, yes, sir. But I thought the right of privacy would be the one.
You know, it's such a potent argument, and obviously it was a convincing one when the decision— the landmark decision was issued by the Supreme Court in 1973. But as you well know, I mean, there are a lot of conservative legal scholars and anti-abortion activists who to this day insist that there is no right to privacy enumerated explicitly in the Constitution.
Well, and there's not the word privacy.
Yeah.
But when you put together what the people writing the Constitution were trying to do, keep the government out of determining the most vital parts of your life, then there was a right of privacy. And that's just the words the Supreme Court used to describe it. Blackmun was the person who wrote the opinion. He had been the legal counsel for Mayo Clinic before he went on the bench.
Yeah.
And so he was particularly concerned about doctors, the impact of these laws on doctors. And then doctors talked to him at Mayo Clinic about the tragedies that happened because of the laws. Because laws against abortion don't end abortion or keep them from happening. They just make them much more dangerous.
Yeah.
Parkland Hospital in Dallas is a very famous trauma hospital. That's where John F. Kennedy was taken when he was shot. And that hospital had a ward called the IOB ward, infected obstetrics. And it was basically for women who had done self-abortion, who had had illegal abortion, sometimes by people who had no skill and ended up really, you know, perforating and all kinds of problems. And so a lot of the doctors, almost all of them in that period, who were in law school, ended up, if they were in Dallas, working in the IOB ward. So they spent a lot of time trying to save the fertility, trying to save the lives of women who were there because of abortion.
I want to talk with you in more detail about the legal path that you took to arguing Roe in the Supreme Court. But let me just step aside here for a second and ask about your own personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1992, you wrote a memoir in which, for the first time,
mm-hmm.
I think you made public that you have direct experience with this question of abortion.
Right.
Can you tell us that story?
Sure. In the 60s, while I was in law school, I was dating a man, Ron Weddington, and became pregnant. And so I had to finish law school. I had to put him through law school. I had lots to do. And I just could not stop to have a pregnancy at that point. So Ron asked somebody who knew a name in Mexico. I remember it was $400 I had to give him. And we drove to Mexico, found his office. I can still remember thinking, oh, I hope I don't die. And even more than that, I hope no one ever finds out about this. You know, I look back now, it was so scary at the time. But I was back and at work and in school Monday morning.
Even with the cushion of many decades, it still sounds terrifying. I mean, having to, it does sound frightening to me, having to cross the border and put your life and health in the hands of someone you've never even met.
But you think about so many women that have had terrible experiences. I was one of the lucky ones because I had the money.
Well, how much of the fact that, I mean, even though you say you were one of the lucky ones and you had the money, you still had to go to extraordinary means to get this procedure. I mean, how much of your own personal experience is helped drive you to, you know, wanting to pursue Roe the way you and Linda Coffey did all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, certainly part of it, because I didn't want anybody else to ever have to go through that.
Now, you were 26 years old. when you presented your oral argument before the United States Supreme Court. That fact in and of itself is quite remarkable to me.
I think so, too. And now I look back and think, oh, my gosh. But it's interesting because they still think around the Supreme Court that I was the youngest person ever to argue in the Supreme Court, man or woman.
And, I mean, also we should note at that time, all nine justices were men. Well.
Oh, yeah. And there were seven the first time. Then the second time we argued, it was nine men.
And why did it have to go back for that second time?
Well, the first time we argued, there were only seven justices, and there were a number of the judges who felt they should hold it until there were nine judges, because it was such an important and controversial case that it would be better to have the involvement of nine judges.
Huh. Well, we actually have some of the audio from the oral arguments that you gave before the Supreme Court. Again, the oral argument happened in 1972. The decision came out in 1973. So here's a little excerpt. This is where Justice Harry Blackmun is questioning you over what constitutes the rights of a fetus. Here we go.
But here we have a person, the woman, entitled to fundamental constitutional rights, as opposed to the fetus prior to birth, where there is no establishment of any kind of federal constitutional rights.
Well, do I get from this, then, that your case depends primarily on the proposition that the fetus has no constitutional rights?
It depends on saying that the woman has a fundamental constitutional right and that the state has not proved any compelling interest for regulation in the area. Even if the court at some point determined the fetus to be entitled to constitutional protection, you would still get back into the weighing of one life against another.
Help me understand, how did you feel when you were standing before those nine justices and you were making the oral argument? I mean, this sounds so silly, me asking you this, but I got to do it anyway. I mean, were you nervous?
Yes. And part of it was because the outcome of that case was so important. It was going to affect the lives of countless women and families across this country for years. And the only thing is, if you had said to me that day, you're still going to be talking about this in 44 plus years, I wouldn't have believed that.
When you found out that the case had been decided in your favor, it was 7-2, right?
Yes, because then we had nine judges, and I had run for the legislature in Austin, Texas, because I didn't know if I was winning or losing the case. So we thought, well, if we don't win in the Supreme Court, at least you would be in the legislature, and you could introduce legislation to make abortion legal in Texas, and we think we can get the votes to do it.
And when you found out that that
I was in the legislature, yeah. I was in the
Capitol.
What
was your reaction?
Well, first the phone rang and an assistant answered it, and it was a reporter from the New York Times. And that reporter said, "Does Miss Weddington have a comment today about Roe versus Wade?" The assistant who answered the phone said, "Should she?" And the reporter said, "It was decided today." And the assistant said, "How was it decided?" And the reporter said she won it 7-2. And that was so exciting, except just knowing I won but not knowing what the opinion said, what the grounds were. I couldn't really talk to the press much because I just said, oh, I'm so excited. But on what basis was this? So I called a friend in Washington, said, go to the court, get a copy of the opinion, read it, call me back, tell me what it says. And she did. So then the next day I started making comments. Yeah.
Now, Sarah Weddington, of course you know that Norma McCorvey, who was Jane Roe in Roe v. Wade, years after the case was decided, she underwent a total transformation in her view of abortion, and she ended her life being totally opposed to all abortions. That said, I wanted to ask you about your relationship with her during the time of the case, because in 1994, Norma McCorvey had this very interesting, powerful quotation in the New York Times. She was describing how in one of the first meetings she had with you in the early days of Roe v. Wade, that you had met her in a pizza parlor, and she was telling you that she desperately needed an abortion. Then she told the New York Times, quote, "She needed me to be pregnant for her case. I set Sarah Weddington up on a pedestal like a rose petal, but when it came my turn, well, Sarah saw these cuts on my wrists, my swollen eyes from crying, the miserable person sitting across from her, and she knew she had a patsy. Wow. She goes on and says she knew I wouldn't go outside the realm of her and Linda. I was too scared. It was one of the most hideous times of my life. So I wonder what your reaction is to that, that, you know, Norma McCorvey says that she was your patsy.
No, I really respected her for a long time because I had explained to her that pregnancies didn't take as long as cases did. And we would try to do the case as fast as we could and get a decision, but it was unlikely we would get it in time for her to have an abortion. And so we were very careful to explain those things. But the fact that she seemed to have thought now that I should tell her where an abortion was, which was illegal, and probably pay for it because she didn't have any money. No, I'm not going to tell my clients to go do illegal things.
You know, Sarah Weddington, one of the reasons why I just wanted to touch on Norma McCorvey's own transformation in regarding her view on abortion is I think it's sort of emblematic on how unsettled the nation as a whole still feels. I mean, Roe happened, it's still legal, but obviously abortion is one of the most controversial issues in the United States today. I mean, we were looking at state-by-state statistics and found that some 22 states right now in the United States have 6 or more abortion restrictions on the books. So I'm wondering, I mean, regardless of if another a case makes it all the way to the Supreme Court that challenges the constitutionality of Roe itself, it seems as if at the state level it may not even matter because there's been a very successful effort to make abortion access harder and harder. Does that concern you?
Oh, yes. You have a reduced number of doctors who are willing to help women who are in need of reproductive rights issues and abortion. And the more restrictions that are passed, the harder it is for them. In Texas, a lot of those restrictions have been passed in recent years. And so there are for a while there were half the number of abortion clinics that there had been before those laws passed. Now they're even fewer. And so you're making it where women have to travel sometimes across the state, sometimes across state lines. And there was one time when Trump was being interviewed, and the interviewer said, well, what if a woman has to go across state lines? And he said, well, she just has to go across state lines. But that's someone talking who I think has a helicopter of his own and a plane of his own and a big retinue of cars and ways to go and the money. A lot of women don't have that.
Are you concerned that under a Trump administration, if we get more than just this one new Supreme Court seat, if we get some more substantial change in the court, that Roe could get overturned?
I'm worried about that, and partly because Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's one of the advocates for women being able to make their own decisions, is 83. There are another couple of the judges who are late 70s. One judge I'm concerned about but not frantic about, whereas if you ended up with several new judges, then that really concerns me, because if you look at who would be appointing them, who would be confirming them, we could have a situation where we might not be able to keep a majority.
Now, my final question to you, I mean, we've talked a lot about the legal arguments you made in front of the Supreme Court. But I think one of the reasons, maybe the reason why abortion remains such a contentious issue in the United States is that people have profound moral questions about it. So for those folks listening who currently believe that abortion is murder, how do you respond when people say that?
Well, first, I think it's a question of who gets to make the decision, because if you, again, like I said in the oral argument, if you look at the Constitution, it, and even the Bible, talks about when the first breath is taken, not when conception occurs. So I respect that there are some people who have that, once conception occurs, that's it. But I still think it comes down to who gets to make that decision. And I just don't think it could be the government.
Do you ever think abortion will stop being controversial in America?
I would like to think that. I'm not sure I do.
Well, Sarah Weddington, 44 years ago, successfully argued the Roe versus Wade case before the United States Supreme Court. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's been nice to be here, and I'm glad I'm leaving just before the snow.
And Sarah Weddington was honored yesterday at Harvard Law School in conjunction with International Women's Day. Special thank you to the Oye Project at the IIT Chicago Kent School of Law for the audio of that oral argument from Roe v. Wade. You can find a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.